So from what I can tell, like he's trying to do is, you know, this Brentwood's, you know, 2.0. And I'm not sure, obviously, like the dollar's going to take a long time to phase out. So I'm not as sure like the dollar is actually the centerpiece of the strategy as it is a return to real hard assets. And so, you know, we've seen a lot of gold, you know, flowing back into the United States. And I think this kind of goes back to that the point I made. It's like, I think they're actually less concerned with dollars as they are stores of value. You know, it's like, let's opt out. You know, we can like get on the life raft. You know, I think Bitcoin has a tremendous role to play in this upheaval. And also too, I think it plays a you know, important role. We're kind of talking about the idea behind, you know, the sovereign wealth fund. And I think, you know, we're starting to see, like you said, like the first shot, like starting to play out. And it's like, well, for the last, you know, 25 years now, like we've just had endless money printing. You know, it's an absolute shame that the Keynesian mind rot has, you know, proliferated the way that it has, and we've completely removed ourselves from any sort of fundamental. Joe, I know you're, you know, a man of faith, and Michael Schellenberger was on Tucker Carlson like a couple months ago and just like talked about how nobody views things through like a theological lens anymore, and that really kind of resonated with me. And I did a presentation to the Denver Young Catholic Professionals, you know, meetup a couple months back, and about, you know, the overlaps between Catholicism and Bitcoin. And my ending slide was just, you know, Bitcoin is our exodus moment. And, you know, I do think we're in a structural upheaval, as you mentioned. And I always try to, obviously, like a good Bitcoiner does, take a first principles approach to this. And, you know, I would kind of echo, you know, the sentiments of, you know, you and Larry, where, you know, if you take the fourth turning thesis and then you lay like Ray Dalio's 250-year sovereign debt cycle on top of it, like they almost match up perfectly. And I definitely think, you know, we're at the end of both of those things, which is probably going to mean, you know, a more dramatic fourth turning than, you know, would be in its like general 80-year cycle. And so when, you know, I'm working with clients and trying to, you know, frame like a larger investment strategy, like the easiest thing we could do is just opt out. You know, it's like, let's just opt out. You know, we can like get on the life raft, you know.
All right. Welcome back to the Theia podcast, everyone. I'm here with Wyatt O'Rourke. He's a founder of Basilic Financial. Wyatt, how's it going?
Great, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So really excited to be chatting with you. Obviously, we've spoken for several months. You know, we're currently in the process of getting you onboarded to the platform. And, you know, I've learned a lot about your business in that time. I'm really intrigued what it's like to be working in wealth management as, you know, a Bitcoiner, right? And particularly having a wealth management firm that centers around Bitcoin. And so what's it like, right? First and foremost, I think people are interested, what is it like? But also, like, and I'll ask this again, but when did you begin to view this as a business opportunity, right? And, you know, what's the demand like for Bitcoin now, and where on earth is it coming from?
Yeah, you know what, Joe, it's kind of funny. I was doing some research about this the other day, and, you know, this was just ChatGPT, so we'll have a margin of error with these numbers. But I asked, it's like, how many financial advisors are in the US? And it came back with 300,000. Which, yeah, I would believe. It doesn't seem like super off base, but I'm a part of the Bitcoin Financial Advisors Network, and there's like 12 of us, right? So it's like still pretty niche. Obviously, you know, there are other folks, you know, kind of specializing, other FAs specializing in Bitcoin that aren't part of the group. But I think that's just like a really interesting, you know, benchmark. Or, you know, there's so many things in Bitcoin where it's like, oh, we're still early. And, you know, just the day-to-day, I definitely, you know, feel that way on the professional front, which is super exciting. You know, I wouldn't rather be doing anything else than, you know, working with Bitcoin, helping clients, you know, with sound money strategies. And for me, this, you know, journey is not like super unique or anything. I always joke, I got like traditionally trained in finance, so it's like a lot of good that did me. So worked in various parts of finance, but just kind of identified more as an entrepreneur to begin with. I had a startup previously that went bust, and so Basilic was really, you know, my next at bat. And, you know, at that point, you know, I was a Bitcoin maximalist. I give a ton of credit to the space and the Denver Bitcoin community, you know, for me to try to find a business model that, you know, I could start a Bitcoin business. And given my background in finance, I thought, why not try the RIA business model? And so fully independent, say registered firm in Colorado, that gives us a lot of flexibility to work with clients. We've adopted, it's called a human first, you know, financial planning approach. So as opposed to just optimizing, you know, numbers on a piece of paper, you know, we work with clients to really identify what's important to them, which is something that I get a lot of fulfillment out of, because I think that's, you know, just inherent, you know, within the Bitcoin ethos. You know, low time preference. I work with clients on really kind of, I think, putting things into perspective. Like something I've been really kind of obsessed about, you know, more on like the inheritance, you know, planning front, is just, you know, we're the first generations of Bitcoiners, right? And so I think we have a moral and ethical obligation to be not only good stewards of our wealth, but be good examples for how, you know, that Bitcoin wealth is passed down to future generations and future Bitcoiners. And I think, you know, our kids will be kind of looking back at like the history books. It's like the world is watching type of moment. And so just kind of like really just connecting with clients on that human level and making sure they're kind of prepared mentally for that. Because it's not something you think about necessarily in the day to day. And it's certainly not something, you know, we're not the first generation of, you know, stocks, right? So just kind of encompassing that and how it fits into, you know, a client's larger financial picture. You know, we still do work with clients on the, you know, traditional financial side of things, you know, if they want to participate in capital markets. But if they do, you know, we take a very, you know, stringent, you know, fine tooth comb, you know, through whatever strategy they would like to, you know, employ or deploy or, you know, whatever, you know, their goals and risk tolerance are, just because we really try to avoid a lot of the shenanigans that happens in TradFi. And so just being a more of a Bitcoin focused, you know, firm, we just kind of take a different approach to that.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about the history books, you just mentioned it, like, you know, we are the first generation who's really trying to rewrite the existing system we live in. You know, you're doing your part, you know, in wealth management, and we're trying to do our part as a software company. Other people are doing their part as educators, but to some degree, we're all educators, right? And so for the people you speak with, what would you say is the biggest informational gap currently in how people understand Bitcoin? Recently, and this was only temporary, obviously Bitcoin's back up now. There was a period last week where obviously Bitcoin is more of a leading indicator, we know this, but on all of this tariff news, Bitcoin was holding relatively steady. It was up 2%, 2.5% on a day where the NASDAQ was down 5%. And if you go back a little bit further in the month of, over the last month, right, the S&P being down 14%, Bitcoin was largely flat. If you look back to 2020, and this is something that, this is, you know, kind of a comparison that my friend Nick Bhatia spoke about on Twitter, was March 2020, Bitcoin cratered, you know, 25% when the S&P fell 12.5%. Over the last month, S&P fell 12.5%, Bitcoin has been flat. So even though it's happening over an extremely lengthy period of time, and some people might argue that it's just that Bitcoin's a leading indicator, I would argue that Bitcoin is potentially starting to get priced like its monetary properties allow it to, which is an asset you want to own always, good times and bad, right? Something that is the least correlated asset in history. The market seems to be coming around to that. It might be, but we know it's going to take several years, several decades. At the individual level, the people you speak to, what do you think is still the biggest informational gap in people's understanding of what Bitcoin is?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's obviously gotten much more mainstream, so people have at least heard of it. You know, I had to deal a lot with, oh, I'm in XRP, or yeah, I got some ETH, and it's like, no, we're Bitcoin only. And so kind of explaining like the difference. It catches people up, especially if you're new to it. It's like Bitcoin, yes, is a cryptocurrency. It's different than all the other cryptocurrencies. So it's like, that is a decent amount of explaining there. Just like, no, it's different. This is why we only work in Bitcoin. But after that, you know, I've actually been really surprised. You know, I get clients from like a referral or whatever who, you know, didn't reach out to me to like solely work in a Bitcoin focused way. How many people are skeptical of the stock market, you know, specifically? It's like, I meet, you know, a lot of, you know, average Joes, you could say, like off the street. And it's like, yeah, I'm interested in working with you. I want to be, you know, exposed to capital markets in some way. I just don't want to own stocks. And it's like, okay, we got a door open here. And so it was really important, you know, meeting people where they're at. I created like this little like conversation menu on talking to Bitcoin about it. You know, it's like a pretty easy bridge for like gold bugs or, you know, people who are like a little bit more sovereign focused. And so it's like connecting the dots for them there. If, you know, people haven't heard of it, you know, at all, you know, we kind of go a different route. So it's really kind of understanding where they're at, what they've heard about it. And then, you know, you can kind of debunk a lot of the common FUD pretty easily. Still, and to your point specifically, a lot of the pushback I get on a day-to-day basis is just that, you know, it's volatile, and like walking people through the volatility of Bitcoin. And it is, you know, I don't think like the most easy thing to do, especially if you're new to Bitcoin, like explain to somebody or grokking the concept that it is still a very nascent asset class. You know, it's in price discovery mode, and that's not, you know, bad thing. You know, if you look at like the S curve, you know, I think it's on you know, very healthy, if not, you know, excelling, you know, adoption paths, you know, which is very bullish. I talk about different, you know, financial products that are, and service providers, you know, like yourself, that are rolling out, that are going to deepen Bitcoin capital markets. You know, I'd love to kind of dive into to that with you as well. But then, you know, also too, OnRamp has like this great report, and they look at, you know, volatility, and they do an analysis, and there's actually like more good volatility in Bitcoin than there is, you know, bad volatility. So that's, mm-hmm. you know, volatility to the upside, that, you know, Bitcoin holders, you know, can experience that price appreciation. And so that generally, yeah, as we work through these, you know, things, clients tend to get like more comfortable with that. And yeah, I don't hold myself out to be like an active manager. You know, that's not what we do. We're, you know, much more long-term, you know, planning focused. And so I really try to frame that, you know, in the context of the client's individual investment strategy, which isn't that different from traditional capital markets either. But it's funny, you know, the market's been, you know, crazy this last week, and I'm just like, wow, you know, the Peter Schiff's of the world or whatever, always poo-poo Bitcoin for the volatility. I'm like, what do you call this? You know, it's like you're saying NASDAQ down 5%, you know, one day last week before we hopped on, I think it was up, you know, 10%. I was like, this thing's like trading like a meme stock. Like, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. You know, all of these instruments that we generally consider, not you and I, but the market writ large generally consider to be the, you know, the great stabilizer, something you want to get into when there's a lot of volatility. They had like an extremely rough time. And obviously that's because, and I'd love to talk about this with you, of the reciprocal tariffs that kind of ignited the trade war. I likened this on my podcast with Lawrence Lepard last week, which was awesome. If anybody hasn't listened to that, you can go back on the feed and listen to it, or go onto YouTube and listen to it, where I kind of likened this to the first shot in the great American reshoring war. And he likened it to like, we are living very much through the fourth turning, and at the center of the monetary universe has always been the US dollar. I'm of the opinion that that's probably going to stay the same for several years to come, if not decades. But at the same time, you now have confirmed for Matthew Siegel at Bitwise, I believe. I could be wrong. I don't think it's Bitwise. It's somewhere else. But I'm sorry, Matthew, if you're listening. But he confirmed that Russia and China have already begun transacting in Bitcoin for some of their transactions. And so there's a door open now. Now that the American consumer is no longer free to the world, which is kind of how globalism has worked, the American consumer is free at the expense of American jobs, right? Forced to be service workers, people who are formerly manufacturers, blue collar in the United States. They're kind of, and pardon my language, shit out of luck, right? Unfortunately, they have been kind of left behind over the last 50 years. And now, at the direction of Scott Bessent, you know, famous for working with George Soros and, you know, breaking the Bank of England, he's now at the helm of this great reshoring war, where he's basically saying, we're going to restructure the global financial order. He has talked about this. He has hinted to it in years prior. He said one's coming up, and now he's at the helm of it. And a Bretton Woods 3 is coming up. And that kind of leaves the door open for a new monetary center of the universe. Lawrence said Bitcoin is uniquely suited to fit that role and kind of be the asset that emerges from the chaos at the center of the monetary universe. What are your thoughts on everything that's going on and how Bitcoin plays into it? That's a very long preamble for a question.
No, I love it. This is very exciting. And just kind of like to expand on that and frame it a little bit, you know, Joe, I know you're, you know, man of faith, and Michael Schellenberger was on Tucker Carlson like a couple months ago and just like talked about how nobody views things through like a theological lens anymore. And that really kind of resonated with me. And I did a presentation to the Denver Young Catholic Professionals, you know, meetup a couple months back, and about, you know, the overlaps between Catholicism and Bitcoin. And my ending slide was just, you know, Bitcoin is our exodus moment. And, you know, I do think we're in a structural upheaval, as you mentioned. And I always try to, obviously, like a good Bitcoiner does, take a first principles approach to this. And the global macroeconomic systems are arguably like the most complex systems in the world, besides maybe like biology. And so I think we need to have like some humility when we're trying to, you know, assess these things, because there's a lot of moving parts. Like, and you can get like caught up in your own narrative, because it's very easy to, you know, cherry pick point A is going to lead to point B, but like you're missing like a billion other variables. You'll be very cognizant of that and like keep an eye, you know, to macroeconomics, but just kind of understanding, you know, let's not paint our own picture and see how things play out. And one of the things that frustrated me with like the market sentiment, or just kind of general financial sentiment last week about the tariffs, where it's like, okay, tariffs are announced. And you know that I'm going to butcher the saying here, but it's like, good generals are like strategists, like great generals are like good at logistics. And that's how I kind of think of this. You know, these hands were made for a keyboard, but I have great respect for people that do things in like the real world, and I have some experience doing that. It's hard. It takes time to like physically build something, ship it halfway around the world, reshore factory, and people are freaking out over like an announcement. It's like, okay, guys, like any shockwave is going to take a lot of time to work its way through a system, but it's ignorant of us to also ignore the trends as well. And, I kind of echo, the sentiments of, you and Larry, where, if you take the fourth turning thesis and then you lay like Ray Dalio's 250-year sovereign debt cycle on top of it, like they almost match up perfectly. And I definitely think, we're at the end of both of those things, which is probably going to mean, a more dramatic fourth turning than, would be in its like general 80-year cycle. And so when, I'm working with clients and trying to, frame like a larger investment strategy, like the easiest thing we could do is just opt out. It's like, let's just opt out. We can like get on the life raft. I think Bitcoin has a tremendous role to play in this upheaval. And also too, I think it plays a important role. And Tom Lugano was on TFTC. And I thought he just said this like really well. They're kind of talking about the idea behind the sovereign wealth fund. And I think, we're starting to see, like you said, like the first shot, like starting to play out. And it's like, well, for the last, 25 years now, like we've just had endless money printing. It's an absolute shame that the Keynesian mind rot has, proliferated the way that it has. And we've completely removed ourselves from any sort of fundamentals. That's why, I tell when I'm talking to clients about like the market, if the market's going to be like this volatile on like news, and that's all it is, like I said earlier, we haven't seen any of this really play out yet. Like it is completely removed from any fundamentals. And I'm not like a huge like Benjamin Graham guy, like value investing, but I think there is something to be said for that. And, it does kind of overlap with like the Austrian economic thesis too. It's like, this needs to be grounded in something, and it's just not, right? And so Bitcoin as, a proof of work decentralized system, I think will be like, play a huge role. And it's like, okay, this is something true. This takes real world physical energy. It's, all the things, scarce, finite, digital, internet, native money. That's going to certainly have a huge role to play in it, especially as people are kind of moving away from fake fiat dollars into real world value.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one thing you mentioned, it's like, stocks are now moving. The S&P 500 is up 10% today. I'm going to look at it now. I had my terminal live, but now that we're recording, I can only use so much bandwidth before the recording quality drops. So I X out of it. I looked on Google, 9.5% today. So, and all that happened was news, right? Basically none of this has gone into effect yet. And so that's not the way it used to be. Then you look at the price to earnings ratio and it's like, oh my gosh, 15X price to earnings ratio on this basket of the best American companies there are. And it's swinging wildly. Granted, it's crazy news, but the fact that we're at, 15X price to earnings, it's not grounded to anything. All of these companies, the only reason they've been able to stay afloat and be profitable quarter after quarter after quarter after quarter and expand and expand and expand is because they have ever cheaper labor, right? And they're just finding ways to cut costs, cut costs, cut costs, cut costs. Right now, Nike stock, I think like last week, it dropped, 15%. On the news that, these huge 96% tariffs in Vietnam that were, on the table. Now they're coming to the table and saying, let's not tariff each other at all. But on that news, Nike stock dropped 15%. Why is that? They have 4,000 factories or 400 across Vietnam employing some like 15,000 or 150,000 workers. I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers, but it just goes to show like these great American companies that are existing in everyone's 4Ks, they only are profitable quarter after quarter and they rise and rise and rise because of like a dollar a day overseas labor and sweatshops and other less extreme examples. But the reality is like these great American companies are virtually not American at all. They're just incorporated in America, right? And they sell to Americans. And so that's basically been the dynamic the world has spun around on for ages. And now we're at a point where you're right, it's gotten so out of hand. The monetary universe, all asset prices are no longer anchored to anything except for one specifically, and that's Bitcoin, right? It's anchored to reality. It's anchored to energy, right? And so maybe you could speak to that a little bit more, right? Like why is Bitcoin so different from everything else? Obviously, it's still traded like a risk asset, but why is it different than, this basket of US equities?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Joe. And this actually kind of relates back to what I think like people have a hard time grokking about Bitcoin is like, there are actually very few decentralized systems, right? And I think that's it's almost kind of a novel concept. You know, I think the internet was kind of intended to be that way, and then, you know, through this, that, or the other thing, you know, ended up, you know, not being. So just the fact that, you know, Bitcoin can't be controlled by a single person, company, country, like the users have, you know, direct influence on the protocol and the developers that work on the protocol, and the asset powers the network and the network secures the asset. You know, these are like two very unique things that haven't existed in one thing before. And the fact that it's like internet native, open source, permissionless protocol is just mind blowing. That's why, you know, I think it was Brandon Quidham that coined it, you know, pioneer species. And it's like, that's brilliant, because it is. So it's just the fact it's like, yeah, and by this time with Klein, I've usually, you know, been talking for like an hour and a half, and it's like, well, you have nodes, right? And anybody can, you know, run a node. It's just like a very basic computer with like the Bitcoin core, you know, code running, and verifies transactions, and it sends it to the miners, you know, to get, you know, compiled into a block. And mining is, you know, pretty decentralized. Probably could be more. I think, you know, we're making, you know, strides on that. Not sure if you're familiar with like the Heat Punk Manifesto. Tyler Stevens, great dear friend of mine, works out of the space, and, you know, they're really focused on decentralizing mining via heat reuse. And so just like there's all these different things that can evolve that make, you know, Bitcoin anti-fragile. It's already proven that it is. And so I think just the fact that it is, one, tied to real world physical energy, and two, a decentralized network, make it immune to central planning. And that is ultimately like how we got to this point in the first place, was central planning. And that worked for a while. And I think it's an absolute shame that through poor leadership, you know, our privilege as the world reserve currency and asset was abused.
It was abused
the way it was.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just about to say the word abused, because that's what's happened. And, you know, my conversation with Larry and kind of my thinking over the last several days, it's so exhilarating, but also very upsetting to be living through this, because it's a consequence of how we have been abused by other nations. Massive privilege to exist in the balance sheet of every major multinational, every country around the world, out of necessity, because they only use us. But what we allowed that to do, again, as you mentioned, through poor leadership, we've basically allowed every single country to totally wax us, right? You know, in terms of just these massive tariffs that they have imposed on us, the currency manipulation that they've imposed on us, right? It's made it completely unprofitable for US companies to operate solely in the United States if they want to grow and they want to expand, right? In very few instances are companies able to make and manufacture everything in the United States and end to end only sell to, you know, American consumers by doing that. As you scale, as you grow as a company, it's an absolute necessity now in our current economic and monetary regime to outsource to, yeah, we're a Delaware corporation, but we have, you know, a factory in the United States. We have 100 in the Philippines, right? That's the way it's worked. And so through poor leadership, through not saying, hey, wait, you can't tariff us this insane amount. We're going to tariff you right back. Trade, right? Global trade, this, you know, this wonderful idea of everybody uses the US dollar. Those are the rails. We can all transact with one another. It's a global competition. They've been cheating in that global competition. And the Treasury Secretary historically has done nothing about it. Janet Yellen has been more concerned about how to control the weather than she has about, you know, fair trade policy. And so it's really unfortunate. But now we're in this place where it's gotten so bad that, you know, the current administration, they're dead set on doing these things. So it seems, right? Regardless of the market reaction, obviously there probably still is a put at some level, right? Particularly with the Fed, what happened with tens, they're now a little bit more tame. I think they're at like 4.2 or something like that. But they freaking launched yesterday, right? I think we were below a four handle. They went all the way up to like 4.58. And so there is a put at some level. I tweeted out, you know, I was kind of posting in jest yesterday, like, this is crazy, this is insane. Someone tells Xi to stop selling tens, which obviously it wasn't all China. It may have been some China, but the speculation is that it was a bunch of hedge funds over leverage on the basis trade. They exploded. They had to sell. They got margin called, right? That's basically what happened. I tweeted in jest that someone said, is this QE? And I said, well, it's certainly what happens before QE, right? If that continued, if we went, you know, 10 basis points higher, 15 basis points higher, who knows, we could have had some kind of liquidity backstop, some kind of bond buying facility from the Fed. And so we were that close. We were that close. And now the administration is kind of dead set. So it seems there still might be a put. There probably will be one from the Fed. But it seems that they're determined to do this. It had to get so bad for the American consumer and for Americans in general, right? you know, I hate to view Americans through a consumption lens, because that's very Keynesian, that's very GDP oriented. But when we're using this type of language, it's kind of what we have to do. And so now Scott Bessent, right, famous for obviously working with George Soros to break the Bank of England, he's dead set on this. He seems to have had the plan several years ago, and he wanted to be a part of it. Now he is a part of it, right? He's the Treasury Secretary. He's trying to initiate this global economic reordering. And largely, he doesn't seem to care what happens to people's 401ks, because the situation is much more dire than that. It's the situation is like we're at the inflection point of what's going to happen in America over the next 50, 100, 150 years, right? The time is now. And so it's either continue going the direction we're going, allow America to continue being hollowed out, allow American consumers to continue having less purchasing power, and just let the world walk all over us, or recenter the United States, right, at the center of the global monetary order, make trade fair again, and make it so that American companies actually manufacture in America, wages rise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think the long-term plan is here for Scott Bessent, for the team that's trying to engineer this great economic reordering? And do they view the US dollar at the center of that universe? Because it seems like a lot of countries are very upset right now at the US, and they're trying to maneuver around it with things like Bitcoin. What do you think the long-term plan is here?
Yeah, I'm optimistic about Scott Bessent's plan. And, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, him and this administration were put between a rock and a hard place, and they could either do something about it or ignore the problem. And, you know, if you just kind of think of it, you know, you made some great points about how, you know, I think the U.S. has been getting fleeced by terrorists from other countries. I totally agree with that. I'm, you know, particularly disappointed in U.S. leadership. Like, it's actually crazy to think, it's 25 years, kind of a long time, kind of not a long time. Like, when Clinton was president, like, yeah, we actually had a surplus, like we had, you know, zero national debt. And the fact that it's ballooned to $36 trillion over like such a relatively short amount of time, I think is absolutely unacceptable. I think, you know, I commonly call the government as like the worst capital allocators of all time. And so, you know, if you just think of this in like terms of health, like, you know, if you eat like crap, you don't exercise and you get really fat, and then you try to get back on a treadmill, like that's going to be painful. Right. And so it's like we've gotten so bloated and so fat in terms of like our economic system. It's like it's going to take, you know, pain and hard decisions. And, you know, a good value of a strong leader is the willingness to make hard decisions. And that's ultimately, I think, what we're going through from a financial lens. And so kind of reading the tea leaves and, you know, interviews I've watched with Scott Bessent and interviews I've listened to, commentary on, you know, what he's thinking. From my perspective, it's about like the one of the only moves you could make without maybe, you know, just going to like a full Bitcoin standard, which we can say optimistic, but a lot to ask, you know, at this day and age. So from what I can tell, like he's trying to do is, you know, this Brentwood's, you know, 2.0. And I'm not sure, obviously, like the dollar's going to take a long time to phase out. So I'm not as sure like the dollar is actually the centerpiece of this strategy as it is a return to real hard assets. And so, you know, we've seen a lot of gold, you know, flowing back into the United States. And I think this kind of goes back to that the point I made about the, you know, Tom Lugano, and they're talking about the sovereign wealth fund. It's like, I think they're actually less concerned with dollars as they are stores of value. And, you know, Scott Bessent on Tucker's podcast was, you know, even mentioned Bitcoin, you know, offhand, like he brought that up unprovoked by himself. And I was like, holy smokes. Okay. I think that's like a huge data point that, you know, he's willing to bring that up so nonchalantly in an interview like that. And obviously the dude's been getting cooked on Twitter and he's been making like all the big news rounds, but I think it makes sense. And, you know, we can't look at just finance in terms of like a vacuum, again, complex global macroeconomic environments. So if you lay tariffs on top of Brentwood's 2.0, on top of the end of globalization, to me, this seems like the directionally correct strategy to take. Like, how do we bring hard assets, that includes gold, Bitcoin, factories, means of production, back at least to the Western Hemisphere, and at the same time try to manage our debt situation? You know, there's been a lot of commentary as well where the administration seems fairly willing, we'll see if this plays out, to quote unquote kill the stock market to save the bond market. And I think that's really kind of based on the idea where, you know, you need money flowing into bonds, and bonds are inverse, so as the price of bonds goes up, so there's more purchasing power or demand to buy bonds, like yields are going to go down. And to your point, like Janet Yellen, if she financed the national debt on the very short end of the yield curve, and it's like we have, I think it's like $9 trillion coming due that we need to try to refinance. And interest rate expenses, they're like our second or third largest line item in the national budget, which is insane that it's even gotten to this point. So if we don't refinance farther out on the yield curve at a more reasonable rate, like we're going to be, left burning a lot of money just, paying our debts, which is, no way to, I think, build the golden age, if we will.
Yeah, absolutely. It's we have an insurmountable debt problem, and we're at the end of the road here. We need to like America needs to take his medicine. And I'm very happy that Trump used the same lingo that I did. I tweeted that out the moment the tariffs were announced. I said the market doesn't like America doesn't like his medicine or something like that. Or I tweeted out the medicine does not taste good. 3 or 4 days later, Trump said a very similar thing. So I'm happy, that happened. But it's true. We're kind of in a situation where, like, America is a very, very sick patient. And these tariffs and all of the downstream effects that are going to happen as a result of them, right? If and when they go live, that's the medicine that America has to take. And unfortunately, now it's in recovery, right? It's a very difficult pill to swallow. The medicine does not taste good at all. And it's going to be a very long and arduous recovery. And I do feel, to your point, at the center of all of that will be hard money. Lawrence said the exact same thing, that like we need a return to hard money, right? We've seen the impact that dislocations between physical reality and money, which is supposed to be our communication mechanism for physical reality, can cause. When you distort that communication mechanism for physical reality, it makes it actually hard to gauge everything. It makes it so that GDP is no longer a measure of economic prosperity. It's literally just a number of how much people are consuming and producing. It doesn't matter what they're consuming and producing or how happy they are to do it. It's literally just this baseline number that no longer means anything. And when we base our whole world around measures like that, that can be distorted and that are not centered around actual prosperity because our yardstick can be manipulated by a central entity like the Fed. And that's where we end up. That's where we have wound up today. For years I've gone out and, for the last 2, 3 years I've posted a great deal of times about, oh, this jobs report was released today, but look under the surface, this is what's actually happening. So many times, like all of the economic data we use is good for trading and that's it. It isn't actually a reflection of the American economy or how American people are doing. How do you view a future world, or even just a future United States where hard money exists at the center? What do you think that that will do for people? What do you think that will do for, family formation and things like that? I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Like, at the end of this road, like if God willing, hard money, Bitcoin exists at the center of our lives, what do you think the world's going to look like?
Man, I think it's going to be prosperous. And I think Lynn, talks about this better than anybody, but it's like money is a market, right? And so, people will choose like the best money that works for them. Unfortunately, through the powers of central planning, that's been kind of a choice that's been taken away from us, but it wasn't, fairly recent times. You look over the course of human history, short term, but that wasn't always the case. And I wrote a piece kind of digging into this, where it's like ultimately thesis or punchline was humanity's fatal flaw is when the technological superpower centralizes the money. And like you said, it was beautiful where, so money's a base market. It's our means of communication. Every other market is built on top of that. And so if you distort the base market, that means you distort every other market. And, so society is prospering as a whole because market signals are clear and there's a succinct and functioning feedback loop. So capitalists are using markets to organize capital, deploy capital, create more capital. And this is ultimately how technology is created. We're technological, beings. I truly believe that. And then, it's bureaucrats and introduce, incentives that become skewed or, markets aren't clear anymore. And you can't make a calculated bet with your capital as opposed to, it's a rather fake facade they created through manipulation. And I think this is actually rather nefarious and just, downright evil. I've, been trying to call a spade, it's a battle of good and evil. It always has been. And so when a market feedback is distorted or manipulated, people lose their ability to make informed decisions. And I think this leads to a profound erosion of their sovereign agency, which is our intrinsic gift from God, because we're designed to thrive on clarity and truth, because we have free will. It's a sacred attribute that allows us to navigate the world with intention, purpose, virtue. And when that's taken away from us, it's actually like a deep humiliation to be stripped of your God-given rights. And this really, I think snowballs fast because the loss of agency, I think plunges individuals in a state of despair. And I don't think it's hard to, walk any city and see individuals in that state. It's not like a state of despair isn't just a momentary lapse in judgment. It's a corrosive force. And that leads to increasingly poor decisions that exaggerate the suffering. And, this distortion, it disrupts our natural order of human existence because we're not wired to function on such constant, overwhelming uncertainty. And you're just like forced to gamble with your capital as opposed to invest with it. And so, that's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's what I think is kind of like the social threads of our, money being manipulated and just really fake. And so if we're able to return to a sound money standard, I think that whole dynamic reverses course and like, the sun is shining. It's like that meme, on the bus and one guy's looking out the other side, it's sad. And then, one guy's looking out the side and it's sunny. It's like, that's how, people can prosper when you can deploy capital via data-driven decisions. And, it's kind of loaded with finance jargon, but I apologize. But, most people think it's like just a good idea to buy a house because houses go up. And it's like, well, what actual data do you have to justify an investment like that? You just kind of do it because everybody does. And real estate's become a store of value because it's scarce and the money's not. It's like, well, you're actually making a gamble then. It's not an investment. And so I'm very optimistic on what a sound money standard can do for just our overall, well-being.
Absolutely. It's very encouraging. You talk about the loss of agency, and I see it, particularly in my generation, Gen Z. People are so demoralized, and it's so great to see, one of the gentlemen I work with over at the Bitcoin Layer, student at USC named Damien. He posted something yesterday that went a little bit viral. He Mailchimp disabled the Trojan
I
Bitcoin
saw
clubs.
that. I saw
Yeah,
that.
yeah. So Mailchimp completely blocked them. They removed their account because they're talking about Bitcoin. But it's people like, and that just goes to show how little companies understand about what's happening here and how important this is. But particularly my generation, people like Damien and myself, we feel very destitute. We've spoken, Wyatt, I'm getting married in August. God willing, we'll be able to start a family soon after that. And I can only hope, the only reason I hope for that and I have the ability to, have faith in that and be comfortable with it, like number one, obviously Jesus Christ, but number two, Bitcoin. Had it not been for Bitcoin being my primary savings vehicle, I don't think I'd be able to get married at 24. I don't think I'd be able to start a family at 24, right? But with Bitcoin serving as my primary savings account, the largest thing that I own, knowing that it's absolutely scarce, knowing that it's neutral, knowing that its monetary policy can't be tampered with, I now have hope, right? But you have people who don't look to Bitcoin or don't know about it. People who maybe not don't even have savings accounts, right? Or they don't have the ability to have savings accounts, right? I'm blessed to have, enough of a capital base, enough income in order to contribute to, my Bitcoin holdings and my savings account over time. But there are people who aren't, right? I know people who have $5 in their checking account who are my age, and still living with their parents, right? It's very, very bad. If you look up rent in my area, literally the suburbs, right? Out in the suburbs, one bedroom apartments, $2,600 a month. Studio apartment, $2,200 a month. If you are working, let's say a job at Starbucks, which unfortunately a lot of college graduates still are, you're not going to be able to afford that unless you have three roommates. And if the standard of living in the United States for our youngest people, our brightest minds who are going to college, is having to share a room with two roommates, having to share a small studio apartment with two roommates because they can't afford anything else, and their job prospects are thin because they went to college and took out a massive student loan and have to make those payments on a degree that isn't even marketable. That's very bad. That's a massive distortion. And so when people lose that agency, it's a type of despair that you can't even really articulate. And you've seen it, I've seen it, I see it in friends and family members, unfortunately. But Bitcoin is kind of that shining light at the end of the tunnel that offers people a form of financial hope, right? Obviously, faith in Jesus Christ is what will ultimately make it clear to you what you are meant to be doing and the path you need to go down and letting him use your hands and feet. But ultimately, your savings vehicle when it comes to your earthly treasures and your earthly capital, that matters a great deal. And Bitcoin is a first of its kind asset, only asset in history that's accessible to everybody and can give them a glimmer of hope that can help them climb out of that lack of agency, which is, it's, I hesitate to say this, but a lack of agency to the extent that you feel you're completely helpless is that's hell on earth.
No, it's beautifully said, Joe, and it's absolutely right. And that, there are early part of the conversation is like, well, you know, what do people like come to me about, you know, asking about Bitcoin? One of the things that resonates with them the most is just when I highlight how the velocity they're getting debased by. You know, when I do a financial plan for a client, and, you know, it's funny, like the software I use, you know, their default inflation is like 2%. I have mine set at 6%, because it, you know, that might even be a little low, but I just go off like the rate of new money creation, which is about, you know, 6-8% over the last 10 years. And it is like, again, I think particularly evil because you're getting stolen from in silence and you can't really like put your finger on what's happening unless you're a Bitcoiner and you've kind of, you know, taken the orange pill. And I think that's, you know, a reason for a lot of this despair. And, you know, I share a similar, you know, life experience. My wife and I are expecting our first kid, you know, this
congratulations
summer, which we're,
again.
Thank you. Yeah. Praise God. We're stoked. But you're absolutely right. You know, it's the same, you know, situation for me. If my primary savings vehicle wasn't Bitcoin, I would be feeling the squeeze. Konstantin Kizik was on What Bitcoin Did. You know, man, it might be over a year ago, but he was talking about the situation in, you know, London. And yeah, it's like, I actually don't know what a flat is. I'm assuming that's just what they call an apartment.
It's their funny word for apartment.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, said a, you know, similar thing where, yeah, in order to afford a rent, you have to, share a small apartment with like five different people. And he directly correlates that to the destruction of the family unit, which I, again, you know, think is evil. It's the best form of governance known to mankind. And so when you do that, you know, and one of the things my wife and I, you know, talked a lot about is you really just, that is like breeding ground for a high time preference, you know, society. And, you know, even as we've been going through the pregnancy, like it's actually, you know, insane how self-focused our modern day culture is. And when you're, you know, constantly focused on self, one, that's like one of the main tricks of the devil. And two, it's like, if you're never actually taking care of another human being, you really don't have the opportunity to, one, live that real world, you know, experience of responsibility and caring for another human, but you also don't have a chance to like sacrifice. So these are things that are tried and true and are human experience. And unfortunately, I think the money is really just like removing these, like they're it's stealing like the opportunity for people to actually be able to experience these emotions and have shared life experience because they're getting stolen from. Economics is very important. And, you know, it's our means of measurement and coordination across individuals in a peaceful way. And so, yeah, if they're getting constantly debased, like, they're actually being robbed of more than just like their monetary value. It's much deeper than that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's because ultimately, like, you know, we should not store up treasures here on earth, right? They will decay, right? And so, you know, rust and moths, I cannot remember the verse for the life of me. I have my Bible in front of me, but I can't remember it. Anyway, that's not what we should be focused on. Ultimately, like, what you should be focused on is building these relationships, right? Doing right by God, whatever he has for you. So, you know, family formation, one of those key things, right? Finding your missing rib, finding your missing puzzle piece. You know, if you're a man, obviously, you know. And so when you can't do that, there's something so demoralizing about it. And like you said, it centers people around the self much more. So often, and my fiance sees these videos on Twitter all the time of women talking about why kids are awful and all of the people that they know. Like, there was one really popular singer who was on a really disgusting podcast, and she was speaking about how all of the women she knows who have children are miserable. And the way she described it, the way she described misery, right, was they have no time to go out and do anything, and they're so tired. That's her definition of misery. When throughout all of human history, right, being able to sacrifice for your kids and not spend time doing pointless stuff, but spending time with your kids and being tired, but so filled with joy because they're your kids. Now that's gone. The sentiment is gone. The sentiment is entirely around the self. And so now, because of fiat money, that's now our mindset. We can't even fathom family formation. We don't think about it. We just live as perpetual consumers in our own individual world. Now we see all of these great joys of life as just something that can take away from our consumption time, right? Whether it's movies or TV or party or video games or whatever. And it's extremely sad to see, because ultimately then those people will go on to live with great regret, right? And if only the money was sound in such a way that it prevented that ethos from ever proliferating to all of society, you would never hear that. But now it's a very popular thing to say, oh, I'll never have kids because I can't do X, Y, and Z, right? They don't begin to think all of the joy they could bring into their life. They don't begin to think of all the joy a marriage could bring into their life. They only think about storing up their treasures, what they could do with what they have on Earth, how to maximize their fun, and, you know, before they leave. And so I don't know where I'm going with this, but the distortions are extremely sad to see. And this is one of the biggest effects that I've seen it have in my own life.
No, yeah, you're totally right. And, you know, I think this can sound, you know, daunting. It's like such a big problem. It's like, how do we even go about solving it? But that's something I really try to work with, you know, with my clients as well, as like framing this. Really, a lot of times, you know, just think of the Bible as like a playbook. It's like, look, you know, we've been prospering for like 2,000 years. It's like, it's not that hard. It's actually written down. You just have to like listen and like follow it. A good friend and mentor of mine, Andy Flattery, he started the Bitcoin Financial Advisors Network, and he really kind of got me onto this idea of the noblesse oblige. And so these were like wealthy aristocratic families of old Europe. I've really tried to take this ideology and, you know, educate, you know, my clients and apply this to Bitcoin, because I just see like a ton of overlaps. And like the whole idea was because, you know, the elites of old, I know that word is kind of sensitive now, and I use it like more derogatory than not, but really, you know, it's like the people of means, like the people with resources, felt a moral and ethical obligation to be good stewards of their wealth and take care of their local communities, right? And to your point, you know, it's like, these are not our treasures, like these are, you know, God's treasures, and it's about how we steward those. And so, you know, these were also like the first, you know, people used to be like very traditional. You know, if you had, you know, three sons, like one went into the military, one went to the priesthood, one went into like politics, but they were, you know, the ones sacrificing, you know, alongside of you. Like if there were a war, like they were standing shoulder to shoulder. They weren't sitting in like the ivory tower. And I think, unfortunately, like our elites of today are totally absent of the, I think, really any like moral light or guidance for the most part, but also like this idea of being good stewards and then, you know, specifically taking care of like their local communities. Unfortunately, for as many, you know, good things of the internet there are, like, you know, like yourself, I kind of view myself as a child of the internet, same generation, and, you know, there's so much good, but, you know, the reality is like our communities have really been, you know, eroded, and that's a shame. And I'm of the belief that, you know, Bitcoiners will be the 1% of political and economic power in the future. And so, you know, we really, I do think, will be like the new elites. And so it's like, well, what do you do with that responsibility? It's like, well, you need to have a moral view around your wealth and around your money and then how you are, you know, a good steward of those resources. And so, really, just to kind of sum that up, it's like, yes, it might seem daunting on the surface, but we have all these lessons, you know, in history we can pull from and embrace and apply to our modern day situation. And I found that like makes this big problem a little less daunting and easier to approach.
Absolutely. You know, you talk about giving back to communities. It's something that I've only seen the level of kind of this level of like altruism and putting others before the self. Maybe some libertarian Bitcoiners will not feel that way, but I've felt a great deal of Bitcoiners putting, you know, others before themselves. You know, you see things like Bitcoin Beach, you know, Susie on Twitter, Susie BDDS, I think, I'm not sure, but she runs a dentistry practice in El Salvador for, you know, poor people, right? For people who cannot afford dentistry. And this level of altruism I've seen in the Bitcoin community, but even more than that, I've seen it in my church. Rivaling the church, the only other area I've seen people being this altruistic is this community that's centered around sound money, that's centered around reality, right? And just if we consider fiat money, if we consider central bankers and manipulators to be evil, it seems like when there is a very, very, very clear enemy, and the enemy is true, it's not a false enemy, right? It's not people marching on Wall Street and saying, you know, take down the banks in 2008. And it's not people saying, you know, big corporation CEOs, we got to eat the rich. But, you know, when you're coalescing around an enemy that is real and that is true, like, you know, like central bankers, right? These manipulators, these people who are seeking to steal from you, right? Behind your back. It seems to me that in those situations, people can truly come around and coalesce. In the same way, in my church, obviously, it's the most tight-knit community I've ever found. It took a lot of work to find this particular church where I live. I live in a very, very hyper-liberal state, you know, in New England. And so it's tough to find a church that preaches from the Bible without any additives, right? And so we found this church. I've never felt God more in any institution, but more importantly, we're all so tight knit. We're all so close. The amount of sacrifice people who we literally have just met, like in the last 2 years, have given to us is simply unbelievable. And the sermon this past Sunday, which I tried to post on X, but I could not download it off of YouTube because I can't find any YouTube downloader that downloads things that are an hour long. But the sermon was about, we went through this 9-week series of Ephesians 6 on, you know, the armor of God, right? We went through literally everything. And the last sermon we had in the series on Sunday was about the devil and how he hates you and that he wants your life to be miserable in every single way. And, you know, my pastor was very no bones about it. He was very direct. He was very straight in saying, like, look, there's someone who hates you out there. He wants your life to be miserable. You need to put on the armor of God every single day to combat that. You know, for Christians, that's a no-brainer, right? For Christians who are, you know, deeply immersed in the word, that's a no-brainer. For Bitcoiners, who would you say the enemy is? What do you think the aim of sound money is? All of this to say, my very long 5-minute preamble, all of this to say, who do you think we're fighting as Bitcoiners, right? As sound money advocates, as people who are, you know, talking about the evils of central banking, who is it we're fighting? What is the end game here? And what can we do to help in this fight?
Yeah, it's a great question. I love the fact you brought up the spiritual armor just because it's true. And I feel like people are kind of shy to talk about that. I got my rosary in my pocket right now. You know, you got to be armed at all times. Yeah, just kind of, you know, put a pin on that and kind of like the whole idea of like the noblesse oblige and kind of like this moral framing of how we use money and our resources. Noblesse oblige is like French for nobility obligates. Luke 12:48 is this verse where it's like, from everyone who has been given much, much more will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. And so that's, you know, just kind of what I mean, where it's like, yeah, we have the playbook. You just got to read it and embrace it. And, you know, when we apply that to Bitcoin and our current, you know, moment, I think we're ultimately fighting the money printer. And River has this great graphic that gets circled up on Twitter every once in a while where they kind of mapped out like the global financial system. It really is complexity by design. So, you know, the Federal Reserve, obviously, you know, they are the money printer, but then how the money gets like prolificated is actually like very complex. I think Mike Benz and now Doge have done like a tremendous job kind of like mapping out how this system works. And unfortunately, you know, it's kind of done legally, you could say, but like under our nose, like this whole NGO complex, like I'm just like totally disgusted with. And it's like how ultimately, you know, people are, you know, achieving the goals of moving money around. And, you know, to your points, like the devil is very clever. You know, it's one of his like best tricks. And, you know, I think it, when I apply this to this ideology to money, it's like, well, the U.S. has actually been very clever on how they prolificate, you know, dollars, you know, whether it's a petrodollar or now weaponizing the dollars, you know, with sanctions or, you know, anything like that. Like, again, you know, I was brought up earlier about applying a theological, you know, lens on this stuff. I think it gets, you know, much easier to identify. And this is actually a great Venn diagram. Alex Vetsky tweet this out. I got it pulled up. And so it's just like on the, you know, three extremes, it's failure to think, complex systems and nefarious scheming. And at the center, it's the vanity of evil. And I think, unfortunately, that's ultimately what our monetary system has evolved in. It's kind of gotten too big for its britches. You know, it's become, you know, overly complex. I think this was just, you know, fuel on the fire when we removed ourselves from any sort of, you know, commodity base or real world asset, like a gold standard. And from there, you know, it was just allowed to run wild. We talked about, you know, failure of leadership. You can kind of correlate that to, you know, incompetence and then, you know, nefarious scheming or, you know, it's related to like the cotillion effects. It's like, unfortunately, I think like the, generally it's like the worst types of people that are attracted to power. And, you know, I think you maybe a bit of oversimplification, but if you can just kind of correlate money to power, well, then they're going to be attracted to the money printer because it's endless money. And so if you kind of identify, you know, these things, I think the whole thing starts making a little sense. And maybe kind of a cop-out answer, but I would say the money printer, but then all its tentacles like are very far reaching, and, you know, we have to be mindful of them too.
It's perfect. Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect analogy because, you know, the devil, like you said, is very clever, right? He comes to people and speaks to them in a language that they will understand, right? But he's lying. He's lying, right? Unlike God, who will speak to you in a language that you understand, but he's telling you the truth and he's telling you what you need. The devil will do the opposite, right? What God is telling you might not be fantastic. It might be hardship. It might be something arduous you need to go through. But then the devil's on the other side saying something that, you know, might be a little bit more enticing, might be a little bit more easy. In the same way, the money printer, right? It's an easy cop-out. It's something that's easy to do, right? As a country, why on earth would I prioritize building up sustainable, lasting industry when I could just fake my economic growth numbers by printing a little bit of money right here and there? It can't be that bad. And then it accelerates and it accelerates and it accelerates and you end up in hell, right? You know, and so I think that's a perfect answer. It's a perfect way to put it because it's understandable, right? It's understandable to everybody. The money printer is the enemy. Understanding that is enemy number one. You know, when it comes to the monetary system, at least is the key in fighting this battle. That's fantastic. The last question I'll ask you, I don't want to keep you for too much longer. You've been very respectful of your time. And this is, you know, one of my favorite podcasts I've recorded, frankly, is how can people position themselves, right? You know, we're going through this fourth turning, our exodus moment, you know, this global economic reordering. What on earth do people do, right? Obviously, you know, in the financial sense, you being a wealth manager, but also spiritually, like how can people prepare for the forthcoming battle? How can people prepare for what's about to come, not just economically, but you know, in this spiritual battle that we're all waging at an individual level, but also as a nation?
No, absolutely. And thank you so much, Joe. This has been an absolute blast. And so for one, on like the moral side of things, I think you need to embrace a moral worldview that teaches you how to embrace sacrifice, how to endure suffering. And it's like our fake hindsight preference secular culture right now is like so adverse to those things. You know, it's like we will do whatever to be comfortable in the exact, you know, moment we want comfort. So I think, you know, a moral worldview that, you know, embraces those things, you know, I give, you know, Christianity, you know, most of the credit for the rise of the West, which I believe is like the pinnacle of human prospering. And these are just core fundamental values to that religion. The second is like what you can do. I think like the easiest way to is opt out, you know, get off zero. And, you know, there are obviously good investments in traditional capital markets, but it's tied to the base unit of the US dollar. And we just, you know, talked about how, you know, it's manipulated and, you know, frankly, unfortunately, you know, evil people that are in charge of it being centrally planned. So you're always going to have some exposure to that in traditional financial markets. And so opting out, you know, I think has never been easier, you know, fortunately. And, you know, it does take time and, you know, education and, you know, you got to go down the rabbit hole, but you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And it is a big responsibility being your own bank. But the flip side of that is you don't have to deal with all these shenanigans and you can live your life the way, you know, God intended for you to live it. Fortunately, you know, I'm seeing one of the things I'm most bullish on is the level of, you know, companies and entrepreneurs that are entering the Bitcoin space. You know, they is a great example of a service provider that makes it easy for people to onboard to Bitcoin, in my view, like the right way, 2 or 3 cold storage, you know, multi-sig. And one of the things I've been, you know, exploring with clients a lot too is like kind of this greater financialization of Bitcoin, you know, movement, which I really kind of view as applying traditional financial tool strategies and products to Bitcoin. And I give, you know, like a company like Build Asset Management a huge amount of props for what they're doing. They have a, you know, private credit fund, you know, which is just like the most standard traditional finance private credit fund. And then you have a company like Unchained who issues loans. And so you as a borrower put your Bitcoin as collateral and escrow account, you get dollars in return. And then Bill buys those loans, puts in a private credit fund, and the yield you receive in it as an investor in that fund is from the loan repayments on a Bitcoin collateralized loan. And so for me as a wealth manager, that gives me a tremendous amount of opportunity. So I may have an older client that needs, you know, exposure to fixed income. It's like, well, now I can get fixed some exposure with the underlying collateral being Bitcoin. You know, it's like, I don't have to rely on sovereign debt to receive a yield. And so that is just, you know, one example of, you know, many things that are happening, you know, within the financial industry that I'm very grateful for and bullish on. You know, I think lending in general, like there's been a lot of movement there and advancements. And I, you know, I just really kind of call on the Bitcoin industry or, you know, financial professionals specifically within the Bitcoin industry to embrace these things, but to do it with the Bitcoin ethos. And I think one of the most powerful things we can do as Bitcoiners is kind of like self-regulate ourselves. certainly no fan of a large state, like a small state maxi, if you will. And so if we don't want regulation imposed on us, like, we have to take it upon ourselves to support and work with and embrace companies that are, you know, doing it the right way. You know, it's like River, they post a proof of reserves. You know, your Bitcoin, while it may be the custodian, is held in a 2 or 3 cold storage wallet that you can verify yourself. And so the more we support, you know, companies that do things the right way, the better potential the market has to grow. And that means ultimately correlates to it being easier than ever before for people to get exposure to a true decentralized, permissionless, sound money. And I'm very fortunate and optimistic about that.
Phenomenal. Extremely well said. You know, there's so many companies building great things in this space. You know, the interconnectedness of Bitcoin within broader finance and using these traditional financial tools, it allows not just, you know, entrepreneurs like yourself with wealth management firms to basically end to end be a part of the Bitcoin ecosystem and still offer products to your users, but it also draws in those massive institutional names, right? And so We're living through a period where, you know, at the same time that this world economic order we've known for so long is collapsing, and it's kind of fitting that Klaus Schwab is resigning from the WEF at, you know, the same time this is all occurring. But, you know, on the flip side of that, the accelerating rate at which Bitcoin is integrating itself into the financial landscape is happening on the other side of that, right? And so, you know, at the same time, there's going to be a lot of misery. There's going to be a lot of people potentially left destitute, and that'll be devastating. On the other side of it, there's a brighter future that's being assembled rapidly today. So that's fantastic. Wyatt, thank you so much for coming on the show. Before we sign off, where can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Joe. This was a ton of fun. You can find me on Twitter at WrOrourke. My website's basilic.io. If you want some of my other writings, you can find it at wideroark.com. Again, we help people with, you know, sound money strategies, and also just wrote a book for Brains, which I'm super excited. That's going to be coming out here. Hard launch will be the Bitcoin conference. I cite you frequently, Joe, so I appreciate your work. And that really kind of delves into, you know, a lot of the infrastructure and underlying dynamics of what we talked about. And so it's like the financialization of Bitcoin is applying TradFi tools, products, and strategies to Bitcoin. The Bitcoinization of finance is a financial system where custody, settlement, and value are unified in one protocol. I break down how that applies to modern finance.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Check all of that out from Wyatt. And if you want to find more of his work, obviously, you know, check him out on X at WrOrourke. That'll be in the show notes and linked if you're watching this on Twitter, which very few people are. I post this stuff on Twitter and people always ask for a YouTube link. So you're probably watching on YouTube, so click the description. And also check out Basilic. If you're looking for any of his services, you can explore them there at basilic.io. That'll also be linked. Wyatt, thanks again for coming on the show, man. Great to talk.
Thanks, Joe. My pleasure.